I think the most successful architects and the most successful projects and buildings are the ones that navigate all of that subjective criteria, distill it into items that need to be, that are rigid, that there's no negotiation, and you come up with a successful project.
Hello and welcome to Architecture, Design, and Photography. Today we are speaking with Eugene Kohlberg, who is an architect with 25 years experience producing award-winning architecture and interiors both in the United States and internationally. He has designed imaginative and environmentally sensitive residential projects, directed projects at recognized New York institutions, and helped master plan higher education campuses nationwide. His retail projects have successfully dovetailed architectural design and brand identity and expression. He has a B Arch from Cornell University, is a registered architect in the state of New York, a LEED Green Associate, and is NCARB certified. You can go to his website at kohlbergarchitecture.com. That's C-O-L-B-E-R-G architecture.com. It's a very impressive website with a lot of impressive projects. And I'm excited to talk to Eugene today. So give it up for the wonderful Eugene Kohlberg. Eugene Kohlberg, welcome to Architecture, Design, and Photography. How you doing?
Yeah, glad to be here. Cool space you got back there.
Yeah,
it's mine.
It's an old mill space here in Maine, and
nice.
It's currently cost effective and a nice creative space. So,
hey, yeah, what's not to love?
But as we get more and more people moving to our town from your town, which there's a huge amount for some reason.
Where are you again?
Biddeford, Maine.
I know a handful of them.
Oh, really?
No.
Yeah, there's, let's see, there's Banded Brewing, started a company here in Biddeford. They're from Brooklyn. Time and Tide Coffee, they're from Biddeford, or from Brooklyn. And there's a few other, and then Wary Myers from Brooklyn. There's a bunch of people that have just decided, like, hey, let's go a little less urban.
Yeah, 20, 25 years ago was Portland.
Right.
I guess now it's your turn.
Yeah, we moved here in 2003, and I looked at Portland, and it just felt like that's already been done, and it's not as much of a blank slate.
Yeah.
So I'm glad with the decision we've made. So.
Yeah, good.
So are you an original Brooklynite, or are you a transplant, or how's that work?
I was born and raised in Puerto Rico.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Eugene Kohlberg, right?
You
would not have guessed it. My family has been there since the 1700s. And oh, wow. I went to school in upstate New York, and I've been here ever since.
Wow. So do you still have family that you can go visit like around February?
Everybody's there except my brother who's up in Boston, but everybody's there.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
Yeah. My brother-in-law has a really cool fishing charter place. So if you're going in February, I'll hook you up.
So what's got you excited about design and architecture these days mostly?
I think that the, what has me really excited, even though I'm a little part of it, but I'm not really doing that much, is I have a bunch of colleagues, both my generation and younger, who are more interested in policy, or not more interested, but that are super interested in policy and have kind of realized that in order to make the changes that our architects and designers we want, the place to do them is in government. So I have friends that are working at the local level with kind of municipalities and local zoning boards and so on. There's other architects, not people that I know, but that are, running for mayors of their towns, running for Congress, running for further elected offices, where you really can make an impact, right? Hmm. There's positions that are appointed by the different elected officials, but if you as an elected official with a design and or architecture background can get in there, the effect that you have on the decisions that are being made is incredible.
So that's an interesting thing to me. So what by policy, being a designer and interacting with policy, the combination of design mind and policy, or, you know, regulations, laws,
right?
What is the change you're looking for, and why go about it through a governmental institution?
Well, because I think that at the end of the day, I mean, so as an architect, right, we are educated, not necessarily in or most schools educate you not in the sort of the nuts and bolts of the profession, but in being critical thinkers and looking at issues of, probably all we do is we solve problems every day of the week, mm-hmm. right? Yep. Paint it however you want to paint it, but
in many ways objective problems, but also subjective reality interaction and feeling problems as well.
And you have to be the biggest optimist, or be the most aloof person to be able to carry this through, right? So, as an architect, right, you're a critical thinker, and there's so many arenas in government that we can get involved. From, you know, climate change and sustainability to making cities more livable, making as low paying interns, you know, we've been in the trenches. We know what livable wages are. We know what different aspects of the work life. So our experience, I think it's multifaceted, and we can affect in a hugely positive way the way that policy is enacted. And at the end of the day, you know, we have on a typical architect client role, we have our master, who's the client. But at the end of the day, you know, the client can. It's a collaboration, right? So at the end of the day, mm-hmm. the client can decide what to do or what not to do. But if the changes or if the work that you're trying to do, you enact it on a policy level, not only the people that you affect is a larger number, but you know, you have to comply with it, right? At some point it becomes a law, at some point it becomes a rule. Mm-hmm. And I think the way that we can shape not only building codes and zoning codes, but again, sustainability and just kind of general human health aspects is incredible.
Hmm. Yeah, that's I have conflicting emotions around that. I have a part of me with my own architecture background and everything else. I'm trained as a critical thinker. What I do all day in when I'm working is, you know, critically approaching a visual problem of representation of essentially an ideal, that we create an ideal image, oftentimes working with not an ideal, and then we have the ability in Photoshop and everything else to
right.
push that ideal.
Exactly, yeah.
You know.
Bump up the contrast.
And yeah, I guess it turns into a conversation about the role of government and why you have government and what it's there for and what it should do. 'Cause I have trust in the architectural practice and the process for very pragmatically approaching design problems. Real world problems that are solved by the built environment, the community environment, town, city. And in that way, there's a lot of training, thinking, and everything else. And then as you establish, like through government agencies, like historic preservation zones,
right.
The practice of, you know, like here in Maine, some of the government policies is like lobstermen, I believe, I haven't verified this, but lobstermen are not taxed on their property because Maine wants to keep that...
Yeah, it's an industry that they want to foster, sure.
Yeah. So that's a government law that people get to take advantage of. And it also has the advantage to the community that, like, there's still this aesthetic and this feel that is valuable of our community. The conflicting emotions that I get a little weird with is that when you take something that's a more subjective position and enact it through what is essentially force, a law,
right?
That's like, oh no, where could this go? Especially if someone with bad taste got in there and started making laws with bad taste, or and influenced it in that way. And so it's always a weird thing, as far as like, I love this policy because I agree with it, but I also know that not everyone's going to agree with me. And is it fair for me to align myself with a policy that personally I feel is good, while knowing that other people have a drastically different existence and might not appreciate it at all in the way that I do? Like, how do you come
well,
to those things?
I hear that, and I think that's exactly what architects do every day of the week.
Right.
On a project.
They have to think outside head into the problem
you
of
have
the client.
You have to be empathetic, number one. Mm-hmm. You have to put yourself in the position of your client. You have to put yourself in the position of a potential occupant or tenant of the space that you're doing. You have to put yourself in the shoes of a passerby, you're trying to design a canopy or signage on a new building, and you need to think about the pedestrians. You need to think about, there's a bus stop in front of the building that you're doing. You have to think about what that experience is, that person waiting for the bus driver. Mm-hmm. So we're used to, and when I say we, I mean, I think that it's architects and probably a lot of people in professional services, especially design.
Yeah,
design. But we have to be empathetic from the get-go. But we also, I think, have to distill a bunch of ideas and a bunch of notions and problems and, call them whatever you want. We have to be able to, whether they're subjective or arbitrary, but at the end of the day, the solutions that we have to provide, right, and I'm talking on a project level, on a project scale, have to be arbitrary, right? At the end of the day, that stair cannot be less than 38 inches wide. The turning radius cannot be less than 5 feet. So I don't care what other ideas are floating around. I mean, there are some sticking points that we need to follow. And I think the most successful architects and the most successful projects and buildings are the ones that navigate all of that subjective criteria, distill it into items that need to be, that are rigid, that there's no negotiation, right, and you come up with a successful project. So when you extrapolate that to policy, I think that same kind of, mix of ingredients in the cauldron are similar, right? You're taking all of these views, all of these positions, all of these, but at the same time, there's different points that don't move. So right, the most successful route or the most successful outcome is going to be where you're able to,
right,
stitching together in a way that works. And not saying anything about anybody else, but the rigor that architects bring to anything that they're doing, is just most often over the top. But anyway, that is something super exciting about the kind of the architectural world as a whole. There's a whole host of projects and buildings and architects that get me excited every day of the week, including some of my own.
Now what you're talking about there brings up a really interesting kind of sidetrack. My mind is just constantly a sidetrack, but the architectural mind has to be trained in both a very liberal and conservative approach. It has to be in a very open and conscientious It has to be both, because you have the laws, which are the objective reality of what you're putting your thing into, and it has to have the conscientious, objective, conservative mind that says 38 inches, no less on a stair, or 7-Eleven, all the laws and everything that we found to be consistent and we protect. That's like the, you know, keep the stairs great again or whatever, you know. And then on the other side, you have this potential of what could be while staying within the boundaries of safety, essentially. So it's like, here's the safety, but on the other side, we could make this a beautiful subjective experience through what is possible while not going backwards on this other side. So on,
you have two more layers to add to that.
Uh-huh.
One is that you as an architect, you're not paying for this.
Right.
Right. Somebody else is paying for it. So you can make that experience as, you know, as life-changing as you can. You can make it as code compliant as you can, but somebody has to pay for it.
Right.
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 And then the other part of this is that we're not building it either.
Right.
Right. So somebody has to build it.
Wow.
So
the architect really does serve as the government, kind of, doesn't it? And it's a very apt analogy.
Right. So, for example, so you have those two things that you started, right? The kind of the rigid points that are not changing, and then how do you make this aspirational?
Yeah.
The space that it is, you know, the space has a every space should have a purpose more than just being shelter and just checking the box,
mm-hmm.
right? So, in that comes. That I think there's a little bit of innate capacity there, but that obviously comes with experience. The other two things that come with experience on the client side and the budget, I think you want to be, and this is something that one of my mentors a couple offices ago drilled in our head every single day of the week. You should strive to be your client's trusted advisor,
mm-hmm.
right? You want to gain that trust. You want to be... you want them to understand that you understand what their needs, capacities, and kind of the reach are for them.
Right.
But then you also need to understand that, for example, if you're doing a concrete stair, and that this comes with experience, there could be a 3 or 4 inch margin of error.
Right.
So you got to oversize everything. You have to have a safety factor, or you know, because you draw those stairs at 3/8, concrete contractor they're not very accurate, undersize it by an inch, you know, you get an inspector, and typically this doesn't happen, but you get an inspector, pulls out a tape, you're an inch short, you're toast.
Yep.
Right? So it's this, so I think we need to be able to not only compartmentalize all of these facets of the project, but at some point, you know, have him in our RAM to be able to just say, oh yeah, that's right. This when I'm advising this person, I got to take into account those 2 extra inches for the concrete, or you know, whatever it is, the reflection on the glass, or you know. But yeah, it's one of the things that I find super super interesting.
Yeah, that
about
it. You've really. Made me realize something that I've never seen before. I was just talking to some very right-wing people last night, we'll say, and I'm not a right-wing person typically at all, but I've learned that, you know, take the architect's mind, for example, if you were to say, I'm going to disregard the subjective experience and only go with the laws of what govern what this project can be,
right.
It would fall pretty flat, but it would be safe. And if you disregarded the other one and went the other way the subjective, it would be chaos.
It would be a fun house.
It would be a fun house. It'd be great, but people would probably die in a fire eventually.
And well, but it's also but the interesting thing is not that you need to find a balance between those two.
Oh, I disagree, but I want to hear the rest of your sentence.
It's that you want to, you want those two things to operate at their max.
Right. Okay,
While serving their function, right? Because you don't want something that's kind of like half fun. I mean, not that code compliance is
You don't want a bad compromise, but it's always a compromise.
It's always a compromise, but with experience, you know where to compromise, where and when.
Right. And that's the answer to our current political just shit show of our country, that you cannot disregard one you can only have this, and you cannot disregard that and think you can only have that. It's in the middle where these things sing, and to wish the demise of one or the other is just asinine.
Yeah, you can't. Right. And it's not that you can't have one without the other. And in this case, I mean, in the case of architecture and design and stuff, there's not just two polar opposites. You have like six of them. You have the budget, the site, the program, the consultants, the timeline, the banks giving financing, investors that want something else, real estate. You know, it's like there's this entire universe that you need to be able to distill in an orderly way that the project makes sense, while at the same time, can I swear on this podcast?
We can swear all we want.
Making a kick-ass project, right? Because at the end of the day, we want to do a kick-ass project. The client wants a kick-ass, but everybody wants a kick-ass project, right? And it's just where does that happen and when, while staying, you know, within the bounds of the game.
Okay, so that's all fine and good. Eugene, when are you running for office as an independent to meet the needs of both liberals and conservatives?
I was gonna be on the local zoning board over here.
That's great.
But I forgot. I got too much work and got busy. I have to look at that again.
I have all these other things too that I'm very passionate about, but I keep getting busy with, you know, not going broke.
Yeah.
Well, that's a great way to start, because that's a really interesting point. When you first pitched that, architects are good for being active in the government.
You're like,
I had no idea where you're coming from. And I was like, but now you've got me convinced. And as long as they are cognizant of like, you can't disregard one for the other, and your value comes by checking the boxes on the conservative side, and then seeing what's possible while respecting that on this side. And that's really beautiful.
I think, like I said, I think we're great at taking 17 different points of view and coalescing them and organizing them and just spitting something out at the other end that makes sense, and it's amazing.
So how do we then apply that awareness of the architectural mind how do we gift that without force, you know? How do we gift that to the rest of the country in some way, shape, or form so they can calm down and stop being so polarized?
I think that at the end of the day, it's about empathy, right? Mm-hmm. And not empathy, not the type of empathy that you sort of identify or feel bad for somebody or whatever it is the capacity to be able to see something from somebody else's position.
Yeah, and as an architect, if you don't do that, you'll go broke.
Exactly, right. And we are in the business of not going broke, most of us. How do people get more exposure? I mean, I think that in... for better or worse, when you live in a city, the urban condition makes you do that.
Mm-hmm.
You makes you be empathetic from the point of view. It's like you have to see. You know, the guy who's begging for money on the subway, or the guy who's yelling on the, because you cut him off on the trying to cross the street or whatever. I mean, at some point, you just like, you can yell back or you can give him the finger or whatever. You're like, oh no, hold on, what happened here? In small town, just neighbors are neighborly in kind of smaller town, or even in in kind of rural areas where you sort of depend on each other because the density is not there. But, you know, I think it's just a matter of just taking a second. And, you know, you don't have to agree with the other point of view, but at least understand it, recognize it.
Yeah, that I think a lot of people are under the false idea that you have to agree with other people because there's only one way of being right.
And yeah, no,
it's
no,
just
no.
not
there's,
true.
Well, know? But that's also the outside of code compliance, right? There's never one right answer in architecture or design,
right?
Right. Like, fine, code compliance, safety, sure. There's one answer, right? The turning radius of a wheelchair is 60 inches.
Like, right.
There's no, you know, no buts about it. Everything else, there could be seven right answers.
Right.
It's just which one makes the most sense at this particular time for this particular budget built by this particular contractor.
You know, what's interesting to me is that it makes me realize that kind of in many ways, the meaning and purpose of our lives is to establish more objective points that are indisputable. So the more you can find those objective points, the more you can simply put them behind you and keep looking into what's possible. At least that's how I feel.
Yeah, no, and when you're, you know, when you're negotiating a contract with a client, or you know, you're negotiating with whatever it is, with a structural engineer that you're trying to get a bigger opening. I mean, it's about finding common ground. It's about finding points that you agree. You know, give a little, take a little, and pick your battles.
Yeah, I'd imagine that is pretty much the political embodiment is the architect and contractor. Like, the contractor is the one tasked with actually turning this into an objective reality.
Yeah.
And they have to take all these, you know, subjective ideas and everything and actually make them happen. And so that's where that, like, that dance comes in.
And not only that, but they need to be able to... I don't have to make a wall straight. All I have to do is draw a straight line.
Right.
Right. It's not...
You have to imagine a straight line.
But to make a straight wall is super difficult.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously different... And we're getting a little off topic, but you detail projects to the type of contractor who's going to build them and the type of capacity that type of contractor has and all that.
Right.
So you already have this in mind when you're doing this extra 2 inches on your concrete pours, or you know, an extra inch on your drywall or whatever. But but yeah. Anyway, it's all a compromise, and it's all trying to understand what the other person is thinking, so you can be a step ahead of them.
Right.
To either avoid conflict or avoid delays or avoid cost overruns.
Right.
So, in
the practice of architecture, which days are you happiest to get up and be an architect because of what you're going to be doing that day?
Well, so in architecture, and this must be similar in other design fields, you have folks and offices that are specialists.
Mm-hmm.
And you have folks and offices that are generalists.
Right.
I worked in a handful of offices, long periods of time in each one. And all of the offices except one were generalist offices.
Mm.
So for example, there was a year, maybe like 2006, 2007, I was doing an art gallery, I was doing a museum, I was doing an apartment building in Brooklyn, I was doing a cemetery, and I was doing furniture.
Cemetery?
Yeah, cemetery. And they work like condos, and I was doing furniture.
Wait a minute. You need an architect for a cemetery?
Yeah.
How
so? It needs zoning drawings, it needs construction drawings, it needs...
So not just a blank piece of land where you're going to be digging holes.
It needs renderings. People want to see renderings.
Yeah. But was this a standard or was it like they're going vertical?
Well, this one was actually a very interesting I'm blanking on the...
Well, I know in the Philippines, they have whole neighborhoods that are little houses that are built for the deceased.
Yeah. Well, so this one, we were doing a master plan. We weren't actually doing the actual like construction drawings, right? But this was a reuse of, it was super interesting. We were working with a super visionary client and they specialize on these, not fringe projects, but these kind of very difficult projects. We were doing this master plan, and it was in New Jersey. It was a property that belonged to a religious order, and it was this gorgeous Gothic structure. Mm-hmm. You know, like you would see at Yale, or you would see it at some of these Northeastern colleges, and they had to sell the property, and they were trying to see what. This client was helping the owner of the building figure out what could the building turn into. We were helping our client with that vision. Hmm. So they had figured out that they could get, it was a campus-ish property. They could figure out, they could get some charter schools to go into some of the other buildings. And the main building, which used to be kind of like this big ornate chapel, kind of had no owner, but I think it was going to be shared between the schools as kind of like assembly space, right? And then it ended up, and it had huge grounds. So some of the outdoor spaces were going to be used as athletic fields for the different schools and kind of yards like you would see in a college. But there was this area that backed into this residential neighborhood. Which, you know, you wanted more passive recreation or kind of more quiet,
cemeteries are quiet,
more quiet program. And it ended up that there was a very small cemetery from that had, interred, folks in the religious order there. Mm-hmm. Right. So there were a couple of zoning maneuvers that we had to do. You know, and we planned out the cemetery and the you know, we had renderings and stuff because there were going to be, you know, you could use the chapel and, you know, you could have little spaces in the chapel, or you can be outside, or you can be like in a mausoleum type building. It was super interesting. So I think back to your question, what gets me super excited is that every day of the week brings something completely different.
Right.
We have, at the moment, we have 20 active projects. Some of them are offices, some of them are retail projects, some of them are multifamily residential towers, single family. We have a deck. We're doing a deck as a favor for somebody else.
You really thrive on changing circumstances challenging you.
And it's that cross-pollination that happens between the big you know, you're like, an old mentor said that they used to do from the spoon to the city. And they were literally doing that. We were doing spoons for a company and we were doing urban planning projects, right? And it wasn't that we had a group doing the spoons and a group doing the houses and a group doing the urban planning. Everybody was kind of doing everything else, which is completely, it might sound chaotic, random, and not profitable at all. And it probably wasn't that profitable, but the amount of knowledge that you get from doing one thing and then applying it on the other,
right?
I think it's great. So, you know, we're like today, I've been working since 5. Mm-hmm. Today I woke up, I was doing some map drawings for a building that I'm doing for some, we need to get like just ridiculous things as like, I need to do a drawing for my building to get a street number in Brooklyn. And then I had a conference call with an outsourcing service that I'm using in India. Then I'm trying to figure out where to fit two passenger elevators and two freight elevators into an existing building that we're designing a bathhouse project. Now I'm talking to you in a second, you know, when we're done, I have a call because we're doing an immersive exhibit space in Soho. And then after that, I have a construction project from a building that we're restoring in Brooklyn. And, you know, so it's this constant just incoming of things that you kind of have to compartmentalize, understand what it is, understand a sequence that you need to do to figure out what the most successful outcome for that day is, but also for the week, for the month, and for the project. You know, and this happens 20 times over, right? Because we have about 20 projects.
Now, if you had the option to specialize in a single building type and continually do that, would that seem a little kind of like my personality would not enjoy that?
I did that for a couple of years. I was at an office called Gensler, and their entire model, which is a very successful model, is that they have studios, and each studio specializes on something.
Right.
Whether it's, and it can get as very detailed as attorney offices.
Right.
Not only offices, but attorney offices or media offices or advertising offices. I was in charge of the retail studio in New York. And the reason that I was doing that was because I think retail is super exciting to do, but also retail comes, it's like the lame excuse of specializing, but not really specializing, because it comes in it comes in a lot of different sizes. It comes in a lot of different flavors. You could be doing retail banking, which we did. You could be doing, fashion stores. You could be doing, we were doing some venues for the NBA. You could be doing food and bev stuff. You could be a prototype kind of design architect. You could be the rollout architect. So within that retail universe, there's a whole host of things that you can do. So it's kind of like the non-specialty. So that's probably what I would do.
Right.
But just because of that, because the options are there's a lot of them.
Right. So it's interesting because the last podcast I just did a little while ago, it was for a high-end residential architect, and he thrived off of finding that bespoke residential homes where right. like that's where he thrived. Right. And so he found like a niche of specialty that he really enjoyed, but for him each project was different. He found the variety in there, and it's interesting how the different personalities can handle a more broad range of change and invigoration, and down to like a smaller range, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you specialize in something like the guest on your show the other day, I think you don't want it to be formulaic.
Right.
Right. The second it becomes formulaic and you're an autopilot, right? But
when efficiency goes up, but creativity suffers and good solutions suffer, I think.
Right. But also, if you're thinking of the high end residential or the sort of the bespoke single family residential project type, you're building a custom glove for somebody.
Right.
Right. And obviously, it depends on budget and schedule and location and, you know, 1,000 other factors, but your job is to design the best glove for that person,
right?
And that glove is going to be different if that person is, I don't know, software engineer, or if that person is a lobsterman,
right.
So, and I think that in that case, I mean, similar to the retail workspace, you know, the differences are that you take this project type and you have to mold it to the specific client. So I think that's where the change comes there. But yeah, the second it's formulaic, it's like, yeah, okay, sure.
Right.
I mean, sometimes you need it, like the you know, in the cycle of a project, when it's like go, and design, and you're on deadlines and documentation and this and that, you know, you get to construction and there's a breather, mm-hmm. and you kind of put this other hat on and you're like, okay, well, my job is now to make sure that everything is done how I was drawn. And if it wasn't, or if it can't be, then we need to find a different solution. So that's always a nice kind of arc to a project on bigger projects. So for example, we do a type of project in Brooklyn, which is apartment buildings,
mm-hmm.
and whether they're condos, which is apartments for purchase, or rentals, you know, it's about, let's just say 10 to 20 stories. That's the kind of the range that we work in. You know, it takes about a year to do the drawings, and it takes about 2 to 2.5 years to do the construction. So that's a kind of long wave, right? And then in the middle there, you have retail projects, which usually take 2 weeks, 4 weeks, maybe 6 weeks to design and document, depending on how rush it is.
Wow.
You know, and sometimes they usually take about 3 to 4 months to build. So that's a higher, you know, that's a higher wave, but shorter, you know, and then you fit those in on that bigger wave. And that's also a way to, going back to your question about makes me excited during the day, that's a way of keeping that kind of low wave interesting. You intersect these other smaller projects in between.
Right.
And for younger staff is a great thing to work on. I remember when I was younger and worked on some projects, and even a couple of years ago in other offices, like it would be like 10-year-long projects.
Oof.
You know, you're working on a hospital, you're doing drawings for 2 to 3 years, right? And then it takes 5 to 6 to build it. I mean, you're doing a terminal in an airport, and all you're doing is drawing interior elevations for 2 years.
Right.
So for younger staff, it's great to work on these smaller, faster projects, because not only there's a ton of deadlines that they can stay late and not me, but you make them responsible because there's not that much to be responsible for. So they can have ownership, they're vested on the project, and you build up a lot of experience really quickly. So in a year, you know, I used to do, when I first started, I used to do a couple of retail stores for high-end chain. You know, in a year we had like 6 stores. So I had gone through not only design documentation, or like, you know, strategic planning, design, documentation, and construction, but I had done it a handful of times. So then at the end of that year, you know, somebody else who was working on a large project, they had just been drawing interior elevations of an airport terminal.
Right.
So anyway, but that's again, what keeps you excited is just this difference of what each day brings.
Well, that's very interesting and somewhat insightful to me to think of it in that wave pattern, that longer wave and that shorter wave. When I worked as an architect for 3 years, and just the fact of going to the same place to work every day, even that part of it, like that was too much. That was too long of a curve for me.
Yeah.
And when I never had interest in photography when you had to interact with a dark room. I did not enjoy that process. I really enjoyed the creative idea and immediate feedback on the idea that's capable within digital, and then also the manipulation that's capable within digital. And as I worked as an architect, I felt like that longer wavelength of creative turnaround was really, really oppressive for me.
Well, that delayed gratification is super difficult.
Yeah.
Which is why also having smaller projects that are done quicker. But on the photography side, I mean, I'll plug in photographers. The importance of photography in architecture is... you cannot discount it.
Now, right? Do we need photography rather than realistic renderings? For my own job security.
I think two things. So I used to be, that's one of the things that they give the intern you know, when you're in a small office and everybody else is busy with other things, which, by the way, that's been a very, very lucky thing that I've been able to take advantage of. Everybody, since graduation until I became even when I left my last job, everybody gave me a long leash. I was like, what are these people doing? They either don't care about what I'm doing, the projects that I'm working don't matter, or people have a lot of confidence in me. And my 21-year-old self, I'm like, I don't know. But one of the things I did was work with photographers. And this was before stuff was digital. So we were shooting Polaroids. We were shooting like five Polaroids to get the exposure right on shoots. You know, we would, every time we traveled for a project, like we had to get, like the photographer would bring film in their bag, but we were always had film FedEx to the location just because the x-ray machine in the airport, like it was just, okay, I don't know how we did it, but the importance of a photographer, and I'll take renderings out for a second and then I'll talk about renderings, is that the photographer, the same way that the architect takes all of this other stuff, distills it into a hopefully successful and aspirational project that checks all the boxes, the photographer not only has the capacity to understand a two-dimensional image, but it also has the incredible capacity to translate a three-dimensional space into, when I keep saying successful, into a successful 2D image. Mm-hmm. And that is something that takes serious skill, serious sort of innate second nature. But also the photographer knows, at least in my experience, just shooting architectural photography, the architectural photographer knows what sells and what doesn't sell.
Right.
And they're able, because they're not so involved in the project, because we're knee deep and, you know, we might be emotional or sentimental about a detail that we spent 3 weeks figuring out that the contractor actually nailed, which we didn't think it was going to. And we want to highlight that the photographer, because they're separated from the project, because they have the spatial capacity to understand what's going on, but also at the same time think what the 2D representation of this thing is, and are able in their head to build a narrative, whether it's a sequential or kind of cinematic narrative through the space or just kind of highlights here and there.
Right.
They're an incredible tool. And it's the easiest and most accessible representation of space that we have. Right, like I can do a 30-second sketch of something and show it to my mom, and she's like, "What the hell is this? What are you showing me?" I'm like, "Well, you know, it's the partie and the center line and the thing and the other, whatever." I show them a compelling image of one of my projects, and like her jaw drops.
Right,
and you know, I could be showing one of my kids and be, you know, see me working on a plan or doing something or checking some shop drawings or whatever, and they're like, yeah. You show them a compelling image of something, and it's this kind of out-of-body experience. Like if that image is compelling and inspirational, you know, it's this like out-of-body experience of like, holy crap, right? So I don't think you can get that on a rendering.
Yeah, and it, as soon as your kid sees it, there's usually an ability to recognize that that's actually real, and that idea of real only comes through in the imperfections.
Which is odd
when you think about it, because if it's too perfect, we know it's not real.
Well, but it's the same. Yes, and I would say that it's the same thing with, or a similar argument with materials that we specify for projects, right? Mm-hmm. Like there's an actual, in this case, there's an actual beauty about the patina that copper gets over time. mm-hmm. right? And you yep. can't really compare it with something that's pre-patinaed or, you know, something like that. But I think the renderings have a place. Whether they're used as a design tool, whether they're used as a way of communicating a design intent, mm-hmm. Whether photorealistic or not. I mean, that's yeah. not it. It's a tool like something else. I think the photography of a project has the advantage of being a post-rationalized version of the project. And not only as a photographer are you trying to hear and understand the architect, and at the same time you're like, yeah, that photo of that detail in the corner doesn't really matter, but I'll take it for you.
Hmm.
But also at the same time, you know, what's the purpose of the shoot? Are we trying to get it in a specific magazine? Are we shooting for a monograph? You know, are we shooting for just pure archives? So yeah. I think I would be a photographer. Like that would be, I think that's so much fun. I don't know about lugging the equipment all over the place. I mean, I guess there's less equipment now. But,
so in listening to you, I'm realizing something that the rendering is the ideal. Here's our idea, and here's what we're going to do.
Yes.
And then the photography is the measure of how successful you were at coming towards that ideal. And
yeah,
if it's too close, if the photograph doesn't represent reality, you're then as the viewer, you're interacting with the ideal representation that they presented before they went through the difficult work of the million points of conflict and failure that you had to get to actually achieve the photograph.
But also photography can capture, going back to the imperfections, I wouldn't necessarily call them imperfections. Photography can capture the details of daily life is not the right term.
Well,
but
imperfections, I don't mean architectural
No, no, I understand
mess-ups
what you mean.
As
no,
much I'm, as like the mixing of natural light and incandescent
right.
and like, you know, there's just a little bit of imperfection to tell your mind, no, this is real. You know,
right.
it's not heaven, it's real.
But also photography, I think, can communicate the uniqueness of the space, the building, the uniqueness of the time of the photograph.
Yeah.
Right. That I don't think rendering does. For example, we shot. I worked in a museum in Harlem years ago, and we had a great photographer, Paul Warshall, shoot it. It was a long time ago. Actually, I think it's being torn down and a new building's going. But anyway, we had these gorgeous renderings for when we actually it was so far back we had watercolors. We had,
nice.
When the project started, we had watercolors, you know, with kids with balloons and stuff.
Right.
Then at some point we had renderings, which were great, very, you know, great for fundraising and stuff. But the photographs, which were beautiful, all of the chewing gum on the sidewalk was there, right? I mean, if you walk 125th Street, like the entire thing is covered in chewing gum.
Right.
But that type of detail and that sort of type of genius loci is the expression. You can't get that in something that's not a photograph.
Right, right.
Right, and that, in that's, you know, the location, in this case for that museum, the location of that museum was completely tied to the nature of their operations.
Right.
So something like the chewing gum on the street, which is a lot, it was a lot of chewing gum. And, you know, and I remember trying to Photoshop it out. But I'm like, no. This is part of the place, right?
Right.
But anyway, yeah. If I could work with photographers once a week for the rest of my life, I'd be a happy man.
If I could work once a week the rest of my life, I'd be happy. Say that.
Yeah.
Let's see. The pandemic has changed how we live and work. Can you tell us how retail and commercial spaces have evolved? Like, the trajectory that how we lived, how we worked, how we shopped, the trajectory before the pandemic. Pandemic. That's a good
one.
I coined it. It's here. I'm going to trade
it. Yeah, exactly.
The trajectory was one thing. Now, from the last 2 years, the trajectory has changed. How so, do you think?
Well, so there's two kind of spheres to this, right? One is you've heard about the entire work-life balance.
Yep.
And how it's been, you know, and a handful of people, actually a lot of people, tell you that it's just unachievable. Mm. Right. That it's more about work-life integration.
Mm. Okay.
That's one thing, right? And then the other thing with that integration, I think, like one of the silver linings of the pandemic, at least from what I can see in Brooklyn and in New York, is that people have become more involved in their local communities. And by local communities, I mean like the you know, you go to the deli more often, you go to the kind of the services that are close by, whether in the block or you know, a couple blocks away. You know, people in the school are a lot closer, not together, right? Because you gotta stay apart, but they've grown closer. So because these people are not somewhere else working, they're spending more time at home in their local communities. And those communities have those communities, businesses, whatever, you know, they have flourished. I mean, at least in Brooklyn, in what I've seen in New York, right? I mean, the downside of that is that the business districts have suffered, and the businesses that are there can't survive. There's nobody there. So I think what's going to be interesting going forward is how do you manage that comeback? How do you make that business district flourish again while keeping the local community still alive, right?
So once bears get a taste of humans, they realize that they're pretty easy prey. And
yes.
And they're like, oh, I don't want to go back to chasing deer
exactly.
that are fat or whatever.
Right.
I think I'm referencing that right. But,
well, no, I mean, once I give my dog a you know, piece of steak, he don't want his food
He's
anymore.
Like, what's this dry crap?
Yeah.
So, I mean, people being able to live, work, and everything in a more localized and in many ways, a more enjoyable commute and interaction
right.
and more community-oriented thing rather than leaving here and going way over there to do that and then come back for, oh, wait, we don't actually have right. to do that all the time. They've gotten the taste of that, not doing that.
Right.
Is it going to go back to that?
Well, I think that there's a balance, right? Like at some point, you're going to be so tired of having to deal with domestic issues at home, whether it's the kids or, you know, it's like that going to work is going to be the break. But I think there's a happy medium in between there. You know, for example, if you live in like an exurb, kind of a little bit farther away, and then there's some scenarios where you could take, for example, shopping malls that are deserted, right? And come in and say, okay, guys, we're going to put in here workplace, right? And then we're going to have a satellite office of whoever it is, Morgan Stanley or Chase or whoever, right? So as a person who's living 2-3 hours away from the business district, I can come in. I don't necessarily have to stay home or super close to home, but I can go somewhere in between where I'm still part of that local community. I don't have the shitty 2-3 hour commute. I have 45 minutes, 20 minutes, whatever it is, mm-hmm. plenty of parking because it's in a retail environment. There's plenty of amenities around, whether it's food and bev or certain different services and whatever, but you're still going to an office environment, right? So you're still
right.
getting the benefit of the what happens when you collaborate in the same space, but you're close to home, right? And if you have to go to the main office once a week, twice a week, whatever it is, right? But I think that there's I mean, again, I think there's a couple silver linings from a planning perspective and from a use perspective that have been the surprises of the pandemic. And to the degree that we can use those as catalysts, right, to revive these old malls or to have these local communities flourish, that'd be great.
I like the idea of reusing malls because I hate malls.
Oh, yeah. I mean, come on. Yeah. I mean, like, Amazon's using them as distribution centers, which is great. I mean, I'm glad that somebody is able to figure out how to take one of these anchor tenants, right, the space of an anchor tenant, and use it for something valuable.
Yeah.
But I think there's also a benefit to infusing, you know, at some point you need to bring traffic back. How do you bring traffic back? You put Workplace there. Workplace then, you know, can attract other businesses, you know, and it's a sort of domino effect.
So what's your take on how the residential sector will change because of this?
Well, so I think it's not going to be, well, I think there were kind of panic decisions that were made about a year ago. And I was involved in a couple of apartment buildings that were like, oh crap, what the hell are we gonna do, right? How are you gonna bring people in elevators? How are you gonna use the gym? How are you gonna use the lounge? How are you gonna do all of this, right?
Right.
And those were kind of panic decisions, and hopefully once everybody's vaccinated and, you know, you go over these hurdles and people can start living similar to what they used to. But there's also the need to accommodate now these people that are working from home, right?
Right.
So there's that extra home office. People get tired of working out of their kitchen table and taking calls while, you know, the pasta's cooking on the back. So there's spatial requirements have changed a little bit, especially in small apartments.
Yeah.
Also in buildings, actually in all the buildings that we're doing now, the part of the amenity package is both not only kind of work lounges, but also conference rooms that you can book.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's one kind of end of things. On the single family side in Brooklyn, we've seen basements dug up, basements reused. You know, people are trying, if you have a brownstone or a townhouse or project like that, or a house like that you live in, how do you optimize it to be, you know, how do you take the forgotten spaces that were unimportant before and make them either do double duty or have a different use? And the basement's been the unsung hero all this, right? It's like I have people, mostly friends, like parents from school and stuff, but it's like, oh, you know, how do I turn the basement? I need to fit a Peloton bike, I need to fit an office, I need to, you know, all this stuff. And it's become a great asset to the people that have it. That was almost a forgotten space.
Right. I keep thinking there's a business model with like home office pods that, you know, you can just buy it on Amazon and they deliver it and it's, you know, plug and play. I've got
like
a home office.
Like a tent?
Well, being in Maine, you need a little bit more
than
a tent.
Well, it could be like a shed.
Little shed,
pre-built shed.
Yeah, like right now I have a shipping container left over. We built a house about 3 years ago and we needed an immediate garage, and I knew I could get a shipping container and use that.
Sure. Yeah.
So, but we're done with that. We've got garage built.
That's an office now.
Yeah, now I'm looking at that thinking, well, if I put glass on one side, put a little wood stove in there and we move it into the woods, that could be pretty cool. So,
sure.
That kind of thing, you know, it would be harder for the kids to run out and say, hey, watch this, or can you read this, or can you reach this at the upper cabinet? I'd actually get more done if I were at home trying to work. So
yeah,
it was definitely that. There's another thing on list of stuff that we should talk about here as far as the multifaceted developments where you've got live, work, shop,
right,
everything all in one building, which in some ways kind of feels like a big box store grab to accommodate everything in one space and then no finances leave the area kind of
thing.
Is this a good thing or a bad thing in your opinion?
Well, I think it could be a good thing. Those usually, I mean, those are popular in China. They're popular in South America. They're super convenient. You know, you have office space. Sometimes there's kind of government offices in there too. You have retail, you have dining, you have...
it's like a whole town in a building.
It's like a whole town in a block, right? I think the problem becomes when you have, you know, you have one of these, then you have an 8-lane highway and you have another one of those, and you have an 8-lane highway and you have another one of those.
Right.
So I think those, and this goes for public space as well, the more program it has and the more successfully you can accommodate the program. And by the program, I don't mean the actual things you fit in, but the kind of calendar of activities and amenities and such, the most successful it'll be. But at the end of the day, it needs to relate back to the occupant and the human scale, both in buildings do a good job at checking that box inside the building, right?
Right.
How the buildings are situated, the scale again of, you know, it doesn't help anybody if there's an 8-lane highway between you and the next block. And that's when kind of policy comes in, right?
Right.
So the more walkable these things are, the shorter they are, or the more they can engage into a kind of a pedestrian scale, mm-hmm. at that lower level, the most successful these projects are going to be. And you see some of them in some recent projects in China doing that, right? Mm. Some of the developers and clients recognizing that, you know, having four towers on a block, or having four tall towers on a block with a podium, and because it gets pretty formulaic after a while, and an open space in the middle or in the corner, and then having some signature space like a theater or something, it's not that successful. It works, it checks the box, it you know, it's great, but the more walkable pedestrian, the more vegetation you can bring into, the more access to light, you know, the better these things will be. And the more you can interconnect them to each other.
So you can do the Minneapolis second floor sky bridge between them all.
Yes, but that connection needs to be outside, and that connection needs to be accessible too.
There was we did a shoot in Manhattan and I think Queens area. I'm not sure. I don't know New York all that well, but we were out east of Manhattan, and we were shooting like six or seven buildings that were going up for sale. And these were massive buildings. And the one that was in a more not expensive part of the city, we were out kind of in the intersection shooting, getting a composition of the whole thing. And we kept having people come by and ask us, like, what are you doing? Why are you doing this?
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. Yes.
It wasn't because there were strangers in their neighborhood. They saw that we were focusing an expensive camera on their entire town of existence, which to them, they said, what are you doing with our town, essentially?
Yeah.
Because within one decision by one person, their whole town goes away. And that's something I'd never considered. My town, Biddeford, the whole existence of it, one person could decide, I'm going to sell it and turn it into something else, and you're going to be evicted. Like, they're all their memories and everything in their community.
It's not that binary, but yeah, I mean.
Yeah, but.
But yes.
It's a different existence and relationship to place. And there's something contradictory to the human experience involved in that that has to be accounted for in some way. Or we just simply lose part of our culture or part of our history or the things that we've evolved to gel with. In that kind of circumstance, It's very disempowering, if that's the right word.
I mean, the connection to place.
Yeah.
And place, I mean, in architecture speak, you call it placemaking. Mm-hmm. The connection to a place and to somewhere that grounds you just cannot be overstated.
Right.
You know, and that's how some of these bigger developments, some of these mixed use developments start becoming genuine, right? Mm. You have to make a conscious effort as a designer and architectural planner of placemaking, and making them places that people can ground themselves and connect to.
And feel that they maybe have some ownership and say, and if they choose to leave that area, rather than I'll be here, I'll invest my life here, but then all of a sudden my neighbors and everything are dispersed.
Right. And that also goes back to the beginning of our conversation about policy, right? Like you need to have the right policy in place to have affordable housing, to have, you know, markets with fresh food available, to have the correct and adequate transportation. And I think, again, that's why architects, I think, feel the draw to go into public policy, because that's where they can most effectively affect that change.
Right.
Right. Most of the time we're just bounded by the property lines.
Right. Right. So my last question here, has to do with consumer behavioral experts and architects, and who has the heavier hand in designing retail spaces. And this is a question that your team has formulated and presented to me. And I think it's really interesting, because I never really thought as much about, there's someone who studies how humans interact with a space when they're considering of spending the things that they buy.
Think of a food market.
Okay.
Where's the milk?
It's in the coolers in the back somewhere.
Exactly. On the cooler in the corner in the back.
Yeah.
So you have to go through the entire store to get to the milk.
Okay.
Guess what happens when you go through the entire store?
You buy other things.
You
see other things. Exactly. And they know that the milk is commonly what you're going to run out of or spoil and need to go. Oh, mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
Where's the deli? Where's the meat? Where's, you know, the yogurt? I think that I think it's a super, super interesting social science.
Yeah.
I think if it can be called that.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
You know, we've worked with a handful of people that study that. And people do that not only for retail now, but they also do it for sport venues. They do it for even college campuses, right? You're trying to determine what are the deer paths and what people go, where do they see, so similar to the structural engineer or any other consultant that's telling you what to do or what ideas are important to them or important to the project, you have to consider it, right? And it's another factor that you put on your chart that you have to comply, think about, modify whatever you're doing. But it's super, super interesting. And the fact that somebody is thinking about this is incredible. You know, and you do it for fashion brands and for food. And but you can also do it for restaurants too, like which is the better table? Is it a two-seater over here and a four-seater over there? Is it a two-top? Is it a bar? Like what, you know, all of these things are, and that's, talk about specializing and not specializing.
Yeah.
There are designers that specialize in that stuff, and it's incredible.
So I would imagine they'd have a psychology or a behavioral, some type of degree and a design degree, like
or a lot of experience.
Yeah.
That they can pull from.
So the mark of a badly planned college campus is that in between all the sidewalks, you keep finding these worn dirt paths then. That
happens all the time.
Right, but if the person looking at that had known.
I know.
You know?
Well, but, you know, in the U.S., campuses, you know, have been built over time and so on. But yes, that's actually a perfect example, right? It's like if you have, you know, this road or this pathway going from here to here, and then all of a sudden there's like this deer path going the other way. I'm like, oh yeah, that's
or if you place a visual interest over there that just naturally draws people and they think, hey, I'm gonna go over there, you know, they just go over there.
It's a super interesting consultant to have on projects. You know, it's like, you know, in residential projects, you have the real estate consultants that tell you what, you know, what apartment at what floor at what size sells and what are the paint-to-paint dimensions and all that. Mm-hmm. You know, all of these specific consultants are there so we can be generalists. So you depend on them to feed you information that you can then kind of process and output on the other end.
That's so interesting that we study ourselves to be able to engineer our environment to predict what we're going to do to more seamlessly create environments that work seamlessly for our natural paths of how we do things. And we do that through social media, we do that through architecture, we do that through planning. It's a very it's a circular, it feeds off itself.
Yeah, it's a self
thing.
Yeah. But in this case, they're all profit driven.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. So I mean at the end of the day you wanna be able to it's interesting. I remember working on an apartment building years ago, and the real estate consultant and the associate architect that we were working with kept referring to, I forget if it was the building or the apartments, kept referring to it as product.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, come on, guys. Like, we're doing architecture with capital A over here. What is this? But then, you know, I was young back then, and you know, with experience, you're like, oh, yeah.
You were more of a rendering at that time, less of a photograph. You're more of a photograph.
The point of this project is to sell apartments. And if the point of this project is to sell apartments, then you have to, you know, in the decision process, you have to understand all of these factors to turn it into a kick-ass building. It happens in retail, it happens in workplace, it happens in residential, it happens in sports arenas, and you know.
Right.
But I think that those guys exist because they're specific and I'm not.
Right.
In terms of focus, right? I can keep focusing on the big picture and have somebody like that say, hey, remember that the bedroom needs to be 10 feet paint to paint.
Yeah. But I mean, it's you are specific. You're just not specific in,
right.
in their specificness.
Yes. And exactly. Yeah, that's what I mean.
That's
right.
really interesting. And for my brain, the takeaway from this whole conversation that's really interesting to me is like as you grow as a human, you accumulate more experience, and you are fed and start out as a rendering. And over time, you become a photograph. And you either become a great photograph with all your imperfections and everything else that you carry with you as both knowledge and wisdom that is an incredible photograph. Or if you insist on that rendering, like if you just try and plow over the realities of life and insist on rendering and rendering only,
you become almost like an airbrushed photograph.
Yeah, a lot of people who might visit things that augment themselves to reflect a younger self rather than a graceful thing at the end. So that's a great place to wrap that up.
There you go.
Eugene, that was a really interesting conversation. I really appreciate your perspective and the insights that you've shared with me that have opened up some doors. It's really great.
Thank you. Yeah, no, that's been awesome.
Cool. Well, I look to see you running for office sometime soon on the national stage. Who knows?
I'll send you a bumper sticker.
All right. Sounds great. Eugene Goldberg, thank you so much for talking with us today, and best of luck.
Thank you.